Welcome to the Michaela Peterson Podcast. This is episode 10. Today's episode, I spoke to Dave Rubin. Dave Rubin is the host of The Rubin Report, the number one political talk show on YouTube with over 1.3 million subscribers, the author of the New York Times bestseller, Don't Burn This Book, public speaker, stand-up comedian, and entrepreneur. He toured with my dad in over 100 cities in 2018 and 2019, something we discuss a bit in the podcast. The most important thing we cover, though, I believe, is why people should be courageous and how they can do that given the current political atmosphere. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to my podcast.
It's good to be with you, Michaela. We had some technical stuff, but here we are, thanks to the internet.
Thanks to the internet, yeah. It was a little rough to get set up in Serbia, but we're here. I wanted to start off by asking, how do you get your hair to look so good all the time?
This is the first time I've been asked that as the top question. I do get that question every now and again lately, which as you know, which I think is why you're asking the question, I've had a little drama related to my hair over the last couple of years.
I haven't. I don't know anything about the drama.
Oh. So I talked a lot about this with your dad and with your mom, because your dad was going through some autoimmune stuff at one point, and I know you've obviously had a whole slew of autoimmune things, and I had my own bout of it. That's why I honestly thought you were asking, actually.
No. What happened?
So this will be an interesting transition to a bunch of other stuff that I'm sure you're going to want to get into. But about 4 years ago, right as my career was kind of blowing up, like right at the beginning of that, when I started telling people, you know, there's something wrong with the left and what's happening to liberalism, I started getting just like this endless slew of online hate and being called a Nazi and a bigot and a homophobe and just like every ridiculous thing that I could possibly be called. And friends were turning on me. In my book, I talk about a girl who was invited to my wedding who suddenly was telling me I'm a Nazi, I'm a bigot, and all like just like horrific stuff. And yeah. I didn't realize this at the time, but you know, I'm pretty calm on the outside. This is how I am if we weren't being recording right now. And if we were just having dinner, this is the tenor that I speak at. But I guess I do internalize a lot of stress. And in late fall of 2015, I was getting my hair cut. And my stylist, Jess, who's a good friend of mine, she said, you better look at this. And she pulled a mirror out and she showed me the back of my head. And I had lost like a bunch of like probably like 2/4 size chunks of hair around my head. And I went to the doctor. I had no idea what was going on. I thought I had cancer or God knows what. And I was diagnosed with alopecia areata, which is an autoimmune mm-hmm. disease, basically where, I'm sure you're aware, where your white blood cells start attacking your hair follicles. And they have no known reason why it happens. They can only chalk it up to stress. So I did all the blood tests. I did, you know, every test you can imagine. They said, there's nothing wrong with you. You're not sick. But it's a stress-related sickness. And over the course of a few months, I lost probably like 45% of my hair. And then even worse, and this is where I think, because I know some of the stuff you've been through, the treatment that I ended up doing ended up being far worse than that. So I'm losing all this hair and I'm doing my show. I'm putting on spray hair and fiber stuff and like literally like painting it on. There was one night with your dad in Denmark where I actually left my bag in Stockholm the night before. I left my toiletry bag there and I had to be on stage, you know, doing our thing. And I realized I didn't have my spray on hair, like my paint, it was like paint almost. And I had to run to a store, like I was freaking out. I did not want to be on stage Aww. With these huge things. And I ran there and I don't know if there's any video of it, but at the beginning of that Denmark show, I am freaking dripping in sweat. Because I had to run and run right back to the theater. Anyway, long story short, I went on a very experimental medication that basically it's like putting poison ivy on your head and it so that your white blood cells, instead of attacking your hair follicles, will attack the reaction, the actual,
wow.
The itch, basically. What that caused, and this is the crazy part, what that caused was my entire body, except my face, which is a freaking miracle, except my face, my entire body, every inch of my body was red and scaly and itchy and like pain. And I was like, I had sores on my head, dripping, oozing. I mean, like horrible, gross stuff that's not fun to talk about. Long story short, I did that for about 4 months. And then I realized that the treatment was actually worse than losing my hair. I stopped doing that. I significantly changed my diet to mostly a paleo diet, got rid of sugars and carbs and that kind of stuff. I do have like one cheat day a week kind of thing now. But I got off that. And then the reason that my hair probably looks great and I keep getting compliments on my hair now is that I do PRP. Do you know what that is? Platelet-rich plasma. So what they what they do basically is I go once every 2 months, they take my blood, they spin it in a centrifuge. I'm sitting in the room and it's just spinning around. They spin it for like 20 minutes and then they inject my own plasma back into my head. And that causes, you know, it's whatever it does, it causes hair growth. And then I take biotin and a couple other supplements, but I do credit actually most of it to diet, and just stop doing things that are inflammatory. So that's really funny that's the first question you're asking me, because I really thought you knew
what I was expecting.
Yeah.
That's really not what I was expecting at all.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, that sucks. I have a lot more, like, since going through this experience with Dad and, like, the hell he's been through from benzodiazepines and all the stress he was under from being called, you know, a Nazi by friends, basically.
Yeah.
I have a lot more sympathy for, like, public figures or celebrities and the stress they're under. I remember, like, Kendall Jenner put out a statement at some point. She was like, I'm actually riddled with anxiety. And the response from everyone was like, why? You live in a mansion with a pool. And it was like, these people, like, it's hard being in the public eye all the time, especially if you're in the political realm.
Look, it's an inside job. You know, your life on the outside, it may look like you've got a zillion houses and every car and everything else, but the internal stuff that we all struggle with, whether it's depression or a medical thing, or, you know, one of the things I talk about in my book is that, like, you know, you can be closeted. People think you can be closeted, it's about your sexuality, but you can be closeted about anything. If you're walking around with some secret that whatever it is that you have, you're not sharing your beliefs with people, that stuff starts to wear on you. And by the way, you know, it's not just me and your dad that's in our circles. There's a couple other people that most of your listeners will know that I don't want to mention by name who have dealt with autoimmune stuff when they're getting hate. You know, like it's a real thing, because you don't know what to do with it. And then your body just starts acting out. Your body's going, wait, I got to get all this stress out. And then suddenly your hair is falling out or whatever else. So, but you know, I remember when we were on tour, your dad would say, he would say it on stage sometimes, but he would talk about it a little further when we were backstage, that he didn't like, people thought he liked being in the fight all the time. You know, like if the New York Times came out with a hit piece and then he responded, like people thought like that's like the fun dance. And he would always say like, you know, I don't really want to be fighting with people. I'm saying what I believe to be true, but I'm not really doing this to fight, or I don't like the hit pieces or the rest of it. And I think that becomes, unfortunately, just the way our media works and everything else, it becomes this like offshoot of, you know, my message is I want people to be treated equally and have open, decent conversation. Like, I don't think that's really controversial. Yet a certain set of people think that apparently is really controversial and just want to bludgeon you with hate. And I think one of the things that your dad and the whole crew of people have done really well is show that none of us are perfect, but if you keep going through it, it won't kill you, even though it's gotten pretty damn close in some cases, but you have no choice, because otherwise it's like, just live your life on your knees. And I know I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm still kind of floored by your hair story. I was like, I'll just start this podcast off light. I was like, whoa, womp.
You know, I still have, I actually do still have like one basically like quarter sized spot back here so my hair's a little longer in the back. But man, it sucks. I mean, you know, you've been through so much autoimmune stuff and dealt with all the ways, you know, conventional treatments, and you've had surgeries and the stuff that you do with your diet. But like all of that stuff, it's like, you look like one thing on the outside, and if you feel like something else on the inside, and when then those things don't match, it's tough.
It's very tough, and it's really horrible when, I mean, it's bad enough feeling one way on the inside and looking better on the outside, but when it starts to hit the outside, it's really scary, and you don't know how far it's going to go, right? Like, alopecia, but then if that's sort of some sort of inflammatory reaction, like what's next? And how do you get it under control? And how do you get it under control if you're under overwhelming stress? And oh, maybe, like you said, maybe you're not noticing how much stress you're under, right? Because you get, you know, you do something somewhat controversial or very controversial to some people, and then you get a whole bunch of hatred on Twitter, and it's like, oh, I'll laugh it off, but you don't exactly know what that does to you.
Yeah. Well, in a weird way, it has almost helped me, I think, in the long term. And that's what I mean by if you can get through it, that you will be stronger on the other side. Because, like, you know, there are videos that I've done that are on YouTube where, you know, I have college kids screaming that I'm a Nazi and throwing stuff and noisemakers and Antifa attacking people and all the stuff that many of us have been through. And in all of those moments when it's happening, I'm actually pretty calm. Like, there were one or two moments over the last couple of years where I was genuinely concerned. There was one night with your dad, I think it was somewhere in the UK, where he was describing a biblical scene, and he couldn't quite remember the imagery exactly. And then suddenly we heard like a crash in the back of the theater, and a guy was running to the theater and kind of started jumping on stage, and then he was tackled. But it turned out, and this really shows like the decency and genius and goodness of your dad. I kind of froze. Like, I thought we were being attacked, and my reaction was just to freeze. Your dad, it was as if he saw it in slow motion. It turned out that the guy wasn't attacking us. The guy had pulled up the image on his phone of the biblical scene, and he wanted to show it to your dad so that he, and you know, the guy just like lost himself. Like, he just, no doubt, he just lost himself. But immediately your dad saw the quick glimmer of it and said, hey, everybody calm down. He wanted to show me the image. It's okay. And yes, security had to remove him. And I don't know what happened after. But like, none of us expect to be in those odd situations just because you're saying what you think is real. And next thing you know, you've got people saying horrible things about you.
Yeah. We just watched, this is kind of out of the blue, but I watched Magnolia yesterday with my dad. Have you seen Magnolia?
You know, I saw it that's Tom Cruise, right? Is that Tom Cruise? No.
Yeah, yeah. Tom Cruise. Yeah, he's in that. Philip Seymour Hoffman is in it. There's a whole bunch of Julianne Moore. But anyway, you should watch it. It's surreal. It's everything about that movie seems incredibly unlikely. And it was like, well, is this just life? Is life just a series of really unlikely events? You just have to get used to that. Or is that just some people's lives? I haven't decided.
I think I saw it way back when, maybe when it came out. But I'll watch it again.
Okay, well, that was an interesting way to get started. Tell me about your book. How's your book been doing? And people, I asked my Instagram following if anyone had questions for you. And one of the main questions was, what's your book about?
Yeah, so the book's doing great. We released it on April 28th, which was, you know, smack dab in the middle of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And, you know, Penguin Random House, which is my publisher, we had all of these talks and they wanted to delay it. And they, you know, nobody knew if even, not only were the stores not open, but could books even be shipped and would everything be delayed and the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I just kept saying, we have to get this out. Like, I finished the book in July. We edited it in the fall. And it's like, when you sit on those ideas forever, it's like they're it's almost like birthing something, I suppose, right? Like, you want to get it out at this point. It sat there, it marinated, and it was like it was time to get out. So the book absolutely crushed it. We you know, we hit the New York Times bestseller, which is a whole charade anyway that people don't know about, but it's like the secret of the publishing world that it's a charade. But at some point, if you sell so well, they can't screw you over, because they, you know, they screwed your dad over. They didn't put him on, and they even though the book sold like 7 million copies or something, which blew out everything, you know, in the last 2 years. So they pick who they want to screw. But we sold well enough that they felt, I guess, that they couldn't screw us. But what I'm most proud of about the book, honestly, is that the things that I talk about in the book about what has happened with the radical left, the destruction of old school liberalism, the destruction of freedom of speech, and that the left really became everything it purported to be against. And that's not necessarily a defense of all of the right, but I come from the left, so that's what I know. You know, everyone sees it now. We called it Don't Burn This Book. I probably should have called it Don't Burn the Store That This Book Is Sold In, because we're watching stores burn now, you know? So that's what I'm most proud of. Like, for the people that are confused about what is happening right now, if you're going, whoa, they're tearing down monuments, they want to take down universities, and they're going to come for Thomas Jefferson house in Monticello and everything else. There is a reason for it. And there were about 20 of us, I would say, over the last 5 years online that were trying to fight it. And we were not treated particularly well by the media. But I will tell you this, I don't think I've said this publicly yet. I just signed the deal for the second book. So that'll be coming out in about a year and a half. And so I'm excited.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it was a real lesson. And I don't want to bring everything back to your dad, but he was so helpful for me in making me realize that I actually could do this. And, you know, I was, it was about 2 minutes before we went on stage in Oslo when I got the call from my agent that the book deal was done. And the advance was way more than I thought it was going to be. And I walk right into the into your dad's dressing room, and he's sitting there with your mom. And I said, Jordan, I just got my book deal. And I told him what it was for. And just because he follows the 12 rules, he was happy for a friend. He lit up, huge smile. He slapped his hands like this. He was in a swivel chair. He completely swung around in the swivel chair. He got up, he hugged me. Your mom, Tammy, came over, hugged me. David was with me, so we all kind of chatted for a little bit. And I think back on that because it is such one of the things that, you know, when you live up to the things that you write about and you talk about, like, be happy for your friends when something good happens to them. Not everybody was like that, by the way. You know what I mean? People get jealous. Yeah. People get weird. It's been quite a ride.
Wow. How many cities did you open for Dad in?
So we did about 120 together. You know, some of them were repeat cities. So I think we did Toronto like 3 times. We did Stockholm twice. So it was, you know, probably around 110 cities total, but it was, you know, 15 or so countries. And it was just absolutely incredible, because to see thousands of people every night, like, just come because they want to fix their lives, and they're doing it. And then, you know, go out. Sometimes your dad and I would walk out to the crowd beforehand. We did that more at the beginning of the tour when it was sort of still under the radar. And then as it exploded, you know, I could do it a little bit more. But, you know, then it became, for your dad, it was like he couldn't walk outside without being completely mobbed. But everywhere we went, you know, we'd get off airplanes and people would have been tracking where we were going to land, and people would be waiting at the airport. And, you know, your dad, I never saw the guy be rude to anyone ever. Like, obviously, you know, he's doing the carnivore, or the lion diet, as it's now called. And, you know, so he'd have to eat wherever he could eat. And even if he was literally just eating some cut up steak at the airport and like starving, if somebody came up to him and said, Dr. Peterson, I just want to tell you, he would stop, he'd shake their hand, he'd ask their name. Like, I just saw that over and over again, and I'm appreciative for it for a million reasons, but it helped, for me, it truly helped lay the groundwork so that I could do what I do now. Like, I'm stronger and better now because of that. And I owe the guy. I know you probably get sick of hearing it sometimes from other people, because for you, he's just dad, but yeah, it's true.
Nah, he's pretty cool. Like, it was for the most part of my life, I was like, that's just dad. And I thought, like, weirdly enough, I thought my mom was the weird one, and she's kind of weird, but it turns out dad's really the weird one. But no, I think he's really cool. So I don't get tired of hearing it, especially after how rough this year has been.
Yeah. Good.
So speaking of people wanting to improve their lives, the other main question I got asked was, given the current political climate, and it is certainly scarier out there now than it was in 2016, 2017, do you have advice for the average person on how to fight back or not be influenced or not be scared in the current political climate?
Yeah, it's a great question. And that is the thrust of what my book is about. I don't think that I'm somehow an exceptional person. For some reason, I say what I think, right? Your dad, I do consider him to be an exceptional person, but what is he doing in essence? He has a breadth of work over decades, and now he says what he thinks. All the people that we admire in the world, every hero in every movie that you love, what do? They say what they think, and yet we live in a time where if you live in the West, you live in Canada, you live in the United States, you are free. You are extraordinarily free. And yet we are the ones putting ourselves in servitude. We're the ones that are silencing ourselves. So I just did a PragerU video a couple months ago called The Bravery Deficit. And I think we have a massive bravery deficit. Now, that isn't to say that there aren't good reasons for being quiet, right? People are afraid of losing their jobs. People are afraid of losing their friends. They're afraid of being mobbed on Facebook and Twitter. That is all legit. So I'm not putting that down. But the problem is that the more that good people, just the average person, right, you know, who has, let's say, whatever moderate political beliefs there are, the more that you're quiet, you think what you're doing basically is you think, oh, I'm just going to let this thing ride. I'm going to ride it out. I'm going to ride it out and it'll skip over me. But that is simply not how this thing works. This radical movement that is spreading like a virus all over the West, it is preying on our silence. So I'll give you a good example. I love the Golden Girls, okay? Every Sunday for the last 10 years, there's a Golden Girls marathon on TV Land, and that's what David and I do for a couple hours. It's like the only television I watch. Well, you may have seen this week that Hulu, which also has the Golden Girls, they announced that they're taking away a season 3 episode of The Golden Girls because Rose, who's Betty White, and Blanche, Rue McClanahan, they're in mud masks, and that's now blackface. Now, the entire episode actually is about the fact that Dorothy's son, who's white, is marrying a black woman, and the families come together. There's some funny jokes about cultural differences and the rest of it. But the entire episode, not only do they get married at the end, the entire episode is about white people and black people coming together. And this is about 1987 or so. Now, Hulu decides to get rid of it. And it's like, who made that decision? And there's some executive somewhere that had to sign something saying, we're going to get rid of the Golden Girls because that episode is racist. I mean, are we going to take out 98-year-old Betty White at this point? But the reason I mention this is no one in their right mind, I could not find one person, even in the hellscape that is Twitter, I could not find one person that thought that Golden Girls episode was racist or worthy of taking down. But so how does it happen? Fear. All it is fear that a whole bunch of us are quiet. And then, I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Neverending Story. It's a great childhood, it's a kid's movie, basically. But there's a creature in it. The bad guy is a creature called the Nothing. And what the Nothing really is that we all of us stop imagining things. We stop expressing ourselves. And that is what the destruction of the world is. And I really believe that that's what's happening right now. We're all afraid to speak. We're all afraid to share. We're all afraid to go out on the edge and really experience what life is, which is figuring out what you think. And the more that we do that, we give room for this evil nothing to come. And next thing you know, we're going to take out the Golden Girls. And then, by the way, you'd have to take out literally every episode of Seinfeld. You'll have to take out every episode of Family Guy and certainly The Simpsons. And now The Simpsons have said that they're not going to have non-black actors play roles that are white, even though The Simpsons are yellow. I mean, the whole thing is so stupid.
Yeah.
But Dad
was not pleased about that.
Right. Well, he would talk about all the time that the one thing he would have you guys watch as kids was The Simpsons. And those formative years, you know, that you take Simpsons, you know, seasons 4 to 10, roughly, that's like the best 6 years of satire maybe in American history. But now suddenly, you know, Apu can't be a character, or at least can't be a character voiced by white Hank Azaria, even though Hank
Are
Azaria...
Are they actually going to change his voice? What are they going to do?
Well, Hank Azaria has said that he's not going to do it anymore. I've heard that they're not even going to have Apu in the show. I mean, I'm not sure if that part's true, but think about how insane this is. Every episode with Apu, I know you've seen them. I mean, the most seminal episode of Apu is the Quickie Mart episode. You know, who needs the Quickie Mart, right? Yeah. The famous song, Who Needs a Quickie Mart? The whole purpose of the episode is to show that he's a true American. He's a hardworking immigrant. There's other episodes where he has an Indian wedding. He talks to Lisa about veganism. He's accepted. Yeah. He's probably the hardest working, best citizen in all of Springfield.
Oh, for sure.
You know, like the rest
and
of them
kindest.
Kind and decent and everything else. But they want to destroy everything. So to fully bring that full circle, this bravery deficit, to answer your question, is what people need to do. I know it sounds scary, but you've got to figure out the spaces where you can speak up a little bit more. It doesn't mean just get on Facebook and say you're a Trump supporter tomorrow, although, yes, you're allowed to support the president of the United States. That's not a crime yet, as far as I know. But whatever little spaces you have in your life to speak up a little bit more, just because your sister, you know, is a radical leftist, you think by being quiet, that's going to make it better. But yet, you know what? 20 years from now, when you've lost all your rights and now all the bad ideas of that, you know, truly govern over you, you're going to go, I probably should have spoke up more. So basically, if you're not speaking up, you're a frog in a slowly boiling pot, and it does not end well for the frog.
Yeah. Okay. That's kind of what I think. I asked my dad, because I was like, some people, what if they're in a position where they're going to lose their job and all their friends? And his advice was, slowly start to make other friends, right? Like, don't be friends with people who are going to dump you if you start telling the truth. Those aren't friends.
Yes, without question, you will lose friends. If you start speaking up against this thing, you will lose friends. You might lose family members.
Sure.
You might lose hair. There's just no doubt about it. But what you will find, and I know this with absolute certainty, is if you start saying what you believe and you lose some friends, which you will find better friends on the other side, because what you will find is you will find people who value you for your truth. And that is so, what is a friendship? If a friendship is a one-way street where they're allowed to say whatever they want, but you can't say what you want, that's actually not a friendship. The part that sucks, especially for young people, is that it really is hard. You're 18, 19, 20, to go, whoa, like, I'm going to say something, and now my friends, like, your whole world is wrapped up in your friends in a way. I think in a weird way, this isn't totally true, and it depends on your temperament, but in a weird way, I think when you're older, and, you know, maybe you have a little more money in the bank, or you have a job or a family or something else, you might be willing to, your whole world isn't totally wrapped up in your friend group. And I think maybe it's sometimes easier, but that partly depends on just how you're wired, I think.
Yeah, I think that might be true, because when you're younger, you're learning, like everything you're learning is from your group of friends, more or less, or at least the ages that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you really take cues on how to act from your friend group. And so if your entire friend group says, well, you're acting wrong, even if you're saying what you believe in, then how are you supposed to know whether you're right or wrong?
Right. And think about the option, though. So let's say your friends, 8 out of 10 of your friends are sort of these radical leftist Marxists, you know, Black Lives Matter, whatever this thing is, whatever you want to call it. Well, if you don't say anything and you don't believe those ideas, you're actually strengthening those ideas, and they're using their power over you, the power that they have to silence you. They're using it as a hammer to just bury you, or a shovel to just bury you. And I think it's your job as a human being to fight for what you believe in, even if that's different than what I believe in. You know, I really believe that.
Yeah, I believe that too. The other thing I've realized in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so is, just because if you have a thought and you feel like saying it and you don't say it, it doesn't disappear. Like, I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't be thinking that or saying that. It'll just go away. But it doesn't. Everything you don't say is still there somewhere, and it'll come back to bite you later.
I love that, because not only is that true, but I think you could probably even expand on that by saying, if you don't say it and if you just try to bury it away, it will either become some weird twisted thing that will make you act out in crazy ways. You know what I mean? Like crazy, crazy ways. Well, the way I can sort of personalize this to you is that when I was closeted about my sexuality, and every gay person knows this, when you have something about yourself that you hide, it's going to come out in crazy ways. Like if you're, without getting like too deep into the weeds on this, like when I was closeted and people didn't know, like I had to meet people online to hook up. I'm not proud of that. You know what I mean? And I'm not proud of it, or in a weird way, I'm not ashamed of it. It just is what it is. But I know that wasn't me acting at my best, right? It wasn't me being a full person that I am now. But what was the reason for it? The reason for it was I had thoughts, I had feelings that I couldn't get out and I felt I couldn't get out in like a functional way, right? So then you do what you have to do. So whatever that is. And I think people think, oh, I could just put that thing aside. But once you put that aside, what you're really doing is you're putting it in the basement of the house. And the house is your brain, in effect. And if it's just sitting there, well, it probably has an expiration date. And when that expiration date comes, it can infect the entire house.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Do you think part of the reason you're... So I completely agree with the bravery issue. Like, I was really disappointed when some of these Black Lives Matter things started happening, and some of the people that were originally pro free speech kind of got sucked up into it. Mm-hmm. And it was like, ah, you were okay, and now you're not okay. Yeah. I don't even know where I was going with that bravery. Yeah.
Well, no, I think.
Yeah.
I got it. You got it. Okay.
Do you think you having to go from closeted to not closeted and talk about that, do you think that's what's triggered your like bravery in this kind of situation?
I think it's at least partly responsible for it, because I've been through it once. I was through it.
Yeah.
I was through that hell once. Like, you know, when you're closeted, like being closeted is like, it's like being a painter and just being like, not going to use blue. Like your set of emotions, the set of things that you're supposed to bring to the world, you're just saying, I don't have some of them, or I have to hide some of them. It's not a good way to live. Like there is nobody, I can't imagine a human being that has come out of the closet and then is worse in the long term. Like, yes, could it be worse in the short term? Your family, your friends, like all of that stuff, even though that's actually pretty rare. Even in more religious communities these days, that's way less rare. In many ways, you'll be propped up by so many people. But I'm not saying it doesn't exist. But I think I was through that hell once. Like, I did drugs I shouldn't have done. I did hookup online thing, and like I did stuff that, again, it's not about regret or shame or anything else, because I'm okay now, you know? Like, so I just view that as like the mix of stuff that got me here. But I think to directly answer your question, I was through it once where I wasn't saying what I felt, and I know what it did to me then. So I could feel it happening again. You know, there's a video that I did. Mm-hmm. I remember really the first video that I did. It was like, it's probably about 6 years ago now, where I for the first time was saying this thing about what's happening on the left about free speech. I did this little walk and talk video. David held the camera. I was just walking in an alley, just saying, what the hell is going on here? And the video kind of blew up, and I thought, whoa, all I did was just say what I'm thinking. That's it, you know? And then from that, it started giving me more courage and more courage and more courage. And one of the cool things that I see now is I see, you know, every time someone comes out of somewhere that suddenly they're having an issue around free speech. So whether it's your dad originally I always forget, is it C-17 or 16?
C-16.
Whether it was your dad then, I didn't know him before that, or whether it's Lindsay Shepherd up at Laurel University, Wilfrid Laurier, or whether it was James Damore or Brett Weinstein or any of these people that just suddenly started saying what they think. They see the monster attack them. One of the things I'm most proud of is that I've been able to offer them some space, usually physically in this room, but now we do it, you know, usually by Skype, to express their feelings. And then what that does is it makes all the people at home go, oh, there are other people like me. And then the hope is that then those people start doing it, and then you don't know what signals you're spreading across the world. And actually, that was one of the things that your dad would often talk about in his talks, that especially with social media, you have no idea what your power is in the world. None of us have any idea. The fact that we can think something, that you can think something right now, put it out on Twitter, and watch it spread. And then maybe you don't see the full repercussions because, you know, you say, okay, I got 1,000 retweets and 2,000 likes. That's nice. But from all the other people that spread that in another way, that you might have sparked some interesting thought that will fight. And that's why even right now, you know, everybody is sort of crazed about politics and everything else. But I'm, in a weird way, the silver lining that I see is that people are waking up. People are waking up, you know, like they're going, what really is happening here? And that's why I don't believe polls anymore or anything like that, because I'm like, yeah, there's just no way to gauge really what's happening right now.
Yeah. And it's interesting going back, watching some of the interviews with people in the, I guess, IDW in 2017, where the journalist on the other side would be like, oh, that's a conspiracy, what you're talking about. It's like, does this... Now, like, not to say I told you so, because you don't really want this happening, because it's significantly worse than it was 2 years ago or even 6 months ago. Although everyone was distracted by the coronavirus 6 months ago. But it's kind of a I told you so. Do you think there's any way back from this, or is North America doomed?
I would go a little bigger than North America. Is the West doomed? You know, like,
yes,
just the general
UK, Australia, they're involved.
Yeah, is the general idea of the West doomed? Well, look. Well, first off, I would say I always describe myself, I'm a world-weary optimist. So I'm an optimist in that I don't think I could do what I do if I didn't believe we could fix things. Because otherwise, what the hell am I talking about all day long? And why am I talking to these people if we couldn't make them better? But I would say I'm world-weary in that I think above anything else, I really do consider myself a realist. I'm sort of like a subtle dreamer, but I'm a realist in that you can't just make the world the way you want tomorrow just because you want it. That's what the Marxists, the progressives are doing. They're just like, let's burn the whole freaking thing down and we're gonna make it better tomorrow, even though these people have never accomplished anything, right? And of course it's a lot easier to burn than to build. I would say your dad would get this question a lot, and I think his answer sometimes would be something like this. He would say, you know, in essence, you have to let these ideas burn, like sort of burn to the ground, because then maybe a phoenix can rise from the ashes. I think the real question about the secondary question there is, what does that burn to the ground destruction look like? Like, does that really, does that take out every institution? And, you know, it's like at this point in the West, like, does the New York Times deserve our respect anymore? I don't think so. Does Harvard deserve our respect anymore? I don't think so. So, but the question is, all right, well, if all of these things burn, and by the way, whether you and I would like them to burn or not, it's too late. Social justice as an idea is a virus. What is a virus? A virus is very easy to catch and very hard to get rid of, right? That's COVID, right? It's very easy to catch and very hard to get rid of. These ideas of social justice, that's why they infect young people. They all sort of sound right. Everyone's racist. You're going to not be racist. Your grandparents must have been evil.
Black lives matter.
The slogans. What are they really good at? Black lives matter. Well, you don't want to say black lives don't matter, so then you accidentally say it as if it means something. Or progressives, what a lovely phrase. I'm a progressive. I'm for progress. But you don't want to be for progress when progress is going to take you off a cliff. What you want to be for is equality. But they're not even for equality. Of course, they're for equity, which are very different things. They're for equality of outcome. So the real issue is, how much destruction does it cause? I will say this. I think that the United States has a better defense mechanism than any other Western country. Not only do we still have the First Amendment for now, so our right to free speech, but we have, you know, the idea of the American, you know, the snake flag, don't tread on me, the idea that Americans are armed, that Americans, you know, the stereotype of an American, you know, get off my lawn and, you know, keep the government out of my life and all that. We really have that, where in many ways they don't have that in a lot of European countries. They don't have that. There is a deeper connection between the government and the people, sort of, that keeps them intertwined, where we're kind of like, I don't want the government in my life. How did our country get founded in the first place? You know, no taxation without representation. So there's a beautiful thing here in the United States that I think can help stand up to it without going too far down the political rabbit hole. I mean, the bizarre truth right now is that Trump is, I would say, basically a necessary evil at this point. If he wasn't around fighting this thing, imagine if it was just a regular Republican in charge right now trying to fight this thing. Imagine if it was Mitt Romney or John McCain, who, you know, I think they're both, they probably, or McCain was and Romney is, I think they're probably both decent human beings. But you know damn well, everyone knows this. Any pick any other Republican, Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or whoever, they could never stand up against this thing. Trump, for whatever reason, he's got, you know, crazy hair and orange skin and he tweets like a crazy person and his affect is weird and all that stuff. For some reason, he can stand up to this thing. So one of my frustrations, you just mentioned how, oh, some people are like, coming, you know, 2 years ago, they were blowing it out of proportion. Now they're, you know, thought we were blowing it out of proportion. Now they're coming around.
Yeah.
One of my frustrations now is I know a lot of public people that on the DL, if I'm out to dinner with them or talking to them privately, they're kind of into Trump because they know he's doing their dirty work. Yeah. But then they spend all day on Twitter attacking him because they still want to go to nice parties. And I'm sort of over that part of life. Like, I got, David's a great chef. We're okay here. I got friends. So I'm not as fearful as that. But I that's one of the things that's really frustrating me these days, that I think a lot of people, they subtly like what Trump is doing. Maybe not the whole package, but like that part of it. But then they spend all day, oh, but I'm so much better, you know? But it's like, man, he's doing the dirty work for you guys.
He's also this, like, life is so ridiculous right now. It could be in the movie Magnolia, and in order to counteract how ridiculous it's getting on the left, you might have to have someone as ridiculous as Trump tweeting out what he tweets out, fighting, like you said, the monster that's there. It makes sense if you think about life as a movie.
Yeah, well, it also makes sense if you just think that there's a certain balance in the world. These guys have gone off the deep end. And what I'm actually worried about more than anything else, and this actually is another idea that your dad would talk about sometimes, is that as the left goes bananas, you know, right now, like, I'm not that concerned with the right in general. I think there's something interesting happening on the right. I think conservatives are a little more open-minded than they've been. You know, I have a lot in common with most libertarians. I think the MAGA crew, I don't think they're racists. I really don't. Now, is there some far right, which really is far left because it's collectivist, is there some white nationalist problem on the right? Well, yes, it's a tiny little thing that has no institutional power. I don't think Trump is part of it. I don't think Tucker Carlson is part of it. And because it's collectivist, it's actually left, not right. But that's a whole separate issue. If you were really far right, that would mean that you're just the ultimate individualist, meaning you don't want government. So, you know, that's like you want to live in Mad Max or something, which I think is kind of fun to talk about, but I don't think is that
it's
real.
I'm
kind of, you know who you should have on your podcast if you want to talk about that kind of stuff? Do you know Michael Malice?
I've heard of him.
All right, I'm going to loop you guys in. He's like one of the great sort of anarchist thinkers that we have, and he's totally fun. You'll love him.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, you'll love him. And I love that. Intellectually, I love that exercise. Like, how much of it can we destabilize and all that? It's not exactly what I think is a functional society, but it's like fun to think about. But in essence, one of the things your dad would talk about is that if you just keep calling Trump racist, you keep calling Trump Nazi, you keep calling half the country bigots, blah, blah, trust me, this is not the bigot. When the bigot comes, you guys aren't even gonna, you will have cried wolf so many times that nobody will know. And that's the one thing that I'm worried about. If the left goes completely bananas and Trump can't stand up to it, he's just not enough and he gets thrown under the bus by well-meaning conservatives or something like that, that what comes after him will be much worse. It will actually be a far right, closer to what there is across Europe, which usually has sort of an identitarian right to it, like a white nationalist right. We don't really have that in America. And I just think if Trump can't hold the line, then nobody can. So we have to be careful what we ask for here.
Yeah, we'll end up with a Dolores Umbridge. I just watched Harry Potter. She's the... I don't know. You're like, who is that?
Dolores, I was like, is she the prime minister of Croatia? Who is that?
Yeah. Okay, I know you have to go right away, so I want to ask you just a couple more questions about what your day looks like as a very productive human. I've been asking a lot of the people I have on my show, like, what's your sleep schedule like? We kind of covered what your diet looks like, how many hours you work, do you exercise, so that kind of thing, just so people have an idea of what they can emulate.
Yeah, well, I like that you're asking that question, because I think right now with COVID and everything else, and we're all trapped at home and all this weird stuff, like, one of the things I've been saying for the last couple of months is, what a great opportunity to really get that stuff lined up, like, get how you eat lined up, get how you exercise lined up, your skill set, like, I'm in LA, so I don't have a huge property here, but we lined our house with planters, and I'm growing all sorts of food now, which I love doing. And like, I've got tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers and all kinds of stuff outside, and broccoli, and I like doing it also because I'm not on my phone. It's like nice for my brain. As far as my day, I don't set an alarm unless I have like a 3 o'clock a.m. radio hit or something. But I usually am up by 6:30. The first thing I do always, I usually pee. And then after I pee, I wash my hands. And then I just have a glass of water, like not even a full glass, like room temperature, like maybe half glass of water, just to like kind of get my system alive. I do French press coffee. I do some mushroom supplements and collagen powder. And that can usually get me going for a couple hours. I used to be a big breakfast person. Occasionally I'll have some oatmeal or some eggs, but not that much. Usually not that often anymore. I kind of wait till about noon. As far as exercise, I have an elliptical machine in the house. I try to do it like an hour every other day. Not even that crazily intensive, but just to just break a sweat and kind of feel right. I talk about this in the book, actually. I try not to have my phone in my bedroom. I think that's actually one of the key things. Yeah. Because the idea that the last thing you look at night potentially is Twitter, or even if it's Instagram or whatever, that you're looking at that screen right before you go to bed, and that then you could wake up and, that I could scroll my Twitter feed and have a million genderless anime Marxist avatars tell me that I'm an asshole. Like, it's not a good way to start the day. We also don't have a television in our bedroom. Like, I think the bedroom is for two things. You could probably figure out what they are. That's what the bedroom is for. So no TV in our bedroom. I try to keep the phones out of the bedroom. When I take my dog for a walk, we never take our phones. So for me, just because of this world that you and I live in, that more and more people are getting sucked into, the endless online world, I think figuring out those moments of disconnect is deeply, deeply important. I don't know if you saw the movie The Matrix, but the idea really of The Matrix is that humans, our carbon bodies, our bodies will basically just be the batteries for the digital world. And in many ways, that's what we're becoming. We spend hours and hours and hours staring at screens, giving our minds and our ideas and all of this stuff just to the digital world. And it's like, man, if you spend more than 12 hours a day, 12 hours and 1 second a day doing that, well, then which world is real? And I think this is going to be one of the like biggest things that we're going to have to grapple with as humans going forward. There's going to be a material world, the world that we have known for thousands of years, well, for millions of years, but with human recorded history, thousands of years. And then there's going to be this digital frontier that is going to be very, very different. It's sort of like Ready Player One or The Matrix. I mean, there's a lot of sci-fi movies on that. But I think doing a couple things that disconnect you, for me at least, that's like the most important thing right now.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of aligns with what I do. I try and sleep with my phone outside my bedroom too, because waking up and going on Twitter first thing is a sure way to like destroy your day.
Yeah.
But thank you very much, Dave. I wish we had more time. But I'm sure I'll talk to you soon. Where can people find you, and where should they go to buy your book?
Yeah, well, you can go to don'tburnthisbook.com to check out the book, and rubinreport.com is the Rubin Report community, or youtube.com/rubinreport. And we're going to get you on my show to talk diet and all that stuff, because I know what it did for you. And that was the funny thing. When I started telling your dad about what was going on with my hair and everything else, that was one of the things that kind of really brought us together, because it's like, you know, when we're public people and people are being nice to us and saying nice things and we're shaking hands and all that stuff, that's like one version of us. But then, you know, mm-hmm. we'd be sitting in, like, you know, often these theaters, even if they're spectacular theaters, the green rooms, you've been there, the green rooms are kind of dumpy and, you know, there's nothing luxurious about them. And we'd be sitting in these tiny rooms, like, kind of talking about what we're struggling with or what we're dealing with and all sorts of stuff, you know, like we really got to know each other in a, you know, what I now look back on in like a very special way. And the diet stuff was a big part of that. So I want to get you on to talk about the Lion Diet. I don't know that I could do, we do a lot of steak now and I'm doing a lot of grilling, but I don't know that I can do full on lion.
It's not ideal. Like, it's not like anyone on the Lion Diet is like, yes, this is how I've wanted to eat for my entire life. Cut out all the cake. Like, no one wants that. And hopefully, I think in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to try reintroducing some plant food, which made some of the people who follow me are like, how could you do that? I was like, you know what? I liked apples. I did. They just made me ill for a while, but maybe they won't anymore. So by the time I come on, maybe it will be an apple and steak diet. Who knows?
We should just have a plate of steak and apples in front of each of us, and we'll see what kind of hate that unleashes into the world.
Yeah, I'm sure it doesn't matter what we talk about. It'll unleash hate somewhere. Okay, I have a few more questions.
Yeah. I'll try to be brief.
Okay. This is completely different.
Yeah.
But what was your favorite guest that you've had on? And your most challenging?
That's a
great.
Are
you allowed to answer that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can. I'm my boss, so the chances I fire myself are pretty slim. Well, look, I've said a lot of nice things about your dad. So the true answer to this is that when I had your dad for the first time in studio, because the first time I interviewed him was on Google Hangouts. I had just moved into this house. Our internet connection was bad. I didn't have a studio yet. Yeah. It was when nobody knew who he was. Also, it was right at the beginning of the stuff. I couldn't quite hear him and the video's freaking out. And when it ended, I said to David, I said, that guy is either the most incredible thinker I've ever spoke to or completely crazy. And that's sort of what I felt. And maybe anyone good is both, right? But when I sat with him in person the first time and I really got to do that dance that you can do as an interviewer. And then even before your dad and I went on tour, we did a couple college gigs together and a few other things. And that sort of expanded on it. But I would say that, especially because truly, I mean, he became the world's most important public intellectual. And I think a lot of that was birthed right here in my garage. Like, that's pretty cool, you know? Like, so I think that's one answer. I would say what was the second part? Was it the most
challenging?
Yeah, most challenging. So this is sort of interesting. Do you know this guy, Stefan Molyneux?
Yeah, yeah.
He just got banned from YouTube, I think, in the last couple of days, and he does a lot of self.
I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, and he does a lot of self-help stuff, and there is he's focused on race and IQ, which is just not an issue I really. It's not something that I care about or think about or anything like that. When I had him on, I really wanted to make sure I did an appropriate interview because those topics are so fraught with peril and dangerous and bring up so many things. And the question that I kept asking him, which I felt was the right question, was why do you care about this, race and IQ? Like, why is it so important to you? I felt it was the right question. I've gotten a tremendous amount of hate for that. I know I've lost gigs for even talking to him. When the New York Times wrote that piece on the IDW, the big piece, they basically threw me and Rogan under the bus because Rogan had talked to Alex Jones and I had talked to him. But, you know, as an interviewer, if you're not gonna talk to people that might be noxious, you're probably not much of an interviewer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Okay. Are you religious? I think there's some news went around at some point that you went from atheist to not atheist at some point. Am I wrong about that?
So I grew up in a mostly secular Jewish home, which is sort of like, that there was like a belief, but it, you know, it's a little different than sort of like a traditional Christian belief where you have to have like a personal relationship with God in that sense. Like the Jewish tradition is more of like, there's like a struggle with God. There's like, you debate about all of these things. That's sort of what I grew up with. And then I had early on in my show a slew of like big time atheists on my show. So Sam Harris and Michael Shermer and Peter Boghossian and a bunch of other guys. And then one day I kind of just said I was an atheist. I didn't fully mean it exactly, but I meant more like, when I said it, I think I meant more like I'm a skeptic, per se. I didn't fully mean like I have a complete lack of belief. Then what happened was, 2 years ago, you know, I do this Off the Grid August where I have no phone, no news, nothing. I literally lock my phone in a safe.
Wow.
And I've done it for 3 years. I'm going to do it again this year, and this year is going to be bananas because the news is so crazy. Can you imagine? I'm going to go off on August 1st, come back on September.
Who knows what'll happen?
We could be in the middle of World War III. Who knows? But 2 years ago when I did it, we went away for a little while. And one of the thoughts, you know, because I gave my brain room to, like, just be, one of the thoughts that consistently popped in my head was that I do believe in something else. I do believe in something outside of myself. And I came back online and I mentioned that, and then suddenly I was getting a ton of hate from the supposed tolerant atheist community. They were suddenly all angry at me. Yeah. Even though I wasn't saying you have to pray, you have to go to church or temple or anything. I was just saying I personally believe in something outside of myself. And then I go into this a bit in the book, but your dad did move me on the importance of biblical stories, and that there are truths that have been time-tested truths throughout generations that have kept society together. So, you know, I know when your dad would get asked some version of this, or do you believe in God, he would always say, I hate this question, because it's so hard to do, and, you know, even if we did this for 3 hours, it's hard to do. But I would say I absolutely believe in something outside of myself, which we can call God, and we can all debate what that specific word means. But I think our founders in America got it right. There are God-given rights. The state did not make me free. It can take away my freedom, but it did not make me free. You are free as a human being. Your birthright is freedom. That is not because a human gave it to you. It's because God gave it to you. Why do we believe that the little guy can beat the big guy? Why do I always attack Google when they crush my videos? Well, you know, there's a story, David beat Goliath, right? There are time-tested stories that I think have value that actually, this is probably the best way I can answer it. It's a functional version of belief. Some people need a belief that is like sort of transcendent and deeply spiritual. That's not exactly what my set of beliefs are. I don't think it's exactly what your dad's are, but obviously I don't want to speak for him. Mine are more functional. It's like we need God and a set of things outside of ourselves to organize a society. And if you don't believe that, well, look what's happening right now. What do you think that these Marxists believe and these communists and collectivists believe? In many ways, we're at the end of secularism right now. Liberalism has basically been demolished. And what do you get at the end of it? You get an absolutely destructive force. And what will be the one thing that will stand up to it? It's going to be some religious and conservative institutions. I think that's a reason enough to be a believer.
I thought I was, well, I was agnostic forever and nah. And then I did shrooms way too many times. And now I have no idea. It's like, there's definitely things out there. So I don't know what I am now. But
I have done shrooms way too many times myself. Not in a while, yeah, but well, yeah.
That definitely helps with the whole atheism thing, I think. Okay. Last question. So you were just being in the public eye puts you under a lot of stress. Do you have tactics? You said diet and things, but do you have anything else that you're using now or that you're trying to put in place for yourself in order not to be overwhelmed by stress?
Well, it's funny. Just as you asked that, I took a deep breath. I don't know if you noticed. I try to take a deep breath every now and again. I mean, literally just taking a deep breath every now and again. That's not, you know, obviously there's yoga reasons to do that and you know, people that are into meditation and all that. I'm not particularly into that stuff, actually. But I do find every now and again, if you just every couple hours, if you just freaking take a deep breath. I actually, not that it's the most brilliant thing in the world, but when I sat down with Eckhart Tolle, you know, he talked a lot about that just that alone can calm you down. So I would say it's the diet stuff. You know, I don't do drugs anymore, really. You know, I smoke pot every now and again, but truly it's I take like a puff before, you know, at like 11 o'clock at night, I watch an old episode of The Simpsons and I pass out. Like that really is it. I don't do any other drugs. I like wine, but I don't really abuse alcohol. So like I could have two glasses of wine, or it was my birthday last week, I had a couple more, but I can't remember the last time I was like stupidly drunk, so I don't wake up with hangovers, you know. I think doing things that basically make your life right. I have a pretty banged up knee at the moment, but I try to go shoot hoops sometimes, even just by myself, just to just do things that'll keep you out of the fight. You know, like I think everyone feels right now that we're in a fight at all times. Politics is now everywhere. You turn on ESPN, it used to be sports. Now they're talking about racial justice. This thing has infected everything. You know, McDonald's Twitter handle now is Black Lives Matter. It's like, I want a burger from you, not a message about whatever that message is. Like everything has caused us to feel that we're just in the belly of the beast all the time. So whether it's controlling your phone, whether it's controlling your appetite, whether it's gardening, you know, I think I've told you David's a really great chef, but I've started cooking more because I think if you do a few other things that just expand your skill set, you don't know where that will lead. So I know none of that's like a magic bullet, but I think collectively they all kind of form something that's pretty decent.
Yeah. Okay. That's all good advice. Thank you, Dave, very much for coming on.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're doing so well. I'm glad that your mom's doing great. Last I heard, I'm glad to see your dad around. And
I'm so glad. Like this last year was so awful. I told you, I watched Magnolia yesterday with dad and it was just like, yep, this is just life. Like how can terrible things just repeatedly happen over and over and over again? But I think we're getting out of it. So,
well, you know what you got to do.
Fingers crossed.
Well, fingers crossed for sure. But you know what you got to do, which I'm sure is probably on your list of things to do with your dad, but you just got to rent Groundhog Day. And I know how much he loves it. I know, you know, that one of the questions we would get a lot in the Q&A is...
That's a good movie. We'll do that next.
Yeah, well, he would get, one of the questions would be, what's your favorite movie? Or especially people say, what's your favorite comedy? And he would always mention Groundhog Day, because it's so in line with Jungian philosophy and so many of the things you're, you know, correcting your... Don't keep making the same mistakes, right? Like, you make it once, you make it twice, but now start figuring it out. So you could do that. And then just do season 4 Simpsons with him. You guys will be great in no time.
You know, season 30, we just watched season 30. Season 30 isn't half bad for The Simpsons.
Is that right?
It was a little weird. Yeah, season 30. Like, we just skipped to the end, but it's pretty good compared to, like, it was a little iffy for a while, maybe, like, 15 years there. But, like, season 30 is pretty good if you're interested.
Well, it's funny because, you know, when you love something, like, the way you guys obviously love The Simpsons, the way I love it, it's like... I don't want it to end, right? But on another hand, it's like they're just sort of bludgeoning it to death. But that's nice to hear. All right, season 30.
Season 30 was pretty good.
I'll give it a go.
Okay. Well, I'll talk to you soon, Dave.
All right, thanks, Michaela.